Hey, what's up? This is Christian with the Most High Show, and today I'm sitting with Dan and Ryan. Yeah, I got those names right. Yeah. Dang. And we're going to talk about meditation. We're going to talk about fear. We're going to talk about judgment, self-judgment, recovery, and
everything.
And Islam. Yeah. So that's the kind of show you're in for. So stay tuned. This is the Most High Show.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
What I love about this, doing this podcast, and with the people I do it with, is there's this level of authenticity that is not common to most worlds, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I like that. I appreciate that. You know, I've gotten to meet a lot of different people. And you sit down and you meet somebody, like I've met, this is the first time I've met you.
Right.
You know, and then you share these like deep, meaningful, profound things about yourself, about life. And there's this level of just like we're not faking the funk.
Right.
And that's just... I love that.
That was something that I've discovered in getting clean is going into the rooms. There's no other place where you can get that, where it's just a group of people that you're just exposing your feelings to, your most inner thoughts.
Yeah.
It's different than going to see a therapist. I saw an addiction specialist for a while, but there's that like that relationship that I'm giving them money for them to listen to me and then to fix me. Right. There's a whole set of expectations that are different than being in a room and just listening to somebody who's going through the same thing that you are.
Right.
And you feel that, and it makes you feel less alone in the world. And it's really hard to work through those things without that kind of support or that hearing it coming from so many different places. And it's people who just want to be there. That's the only right. prerequisite,
right?
You know, and then to see when I share, when I finally get the balls to do so.
Yeah.
That I'm seeing that guy shaking his head going, yeah, you know, and it makes me feel like I'm actually doing something right, which it's different than a therapist saying like, oh, you're doing great. Like, okay,
right.
that's saying more about yourself than you are about me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I have a counselor that's, he's also acts as my coach for business also, which is great. Cause I go in there and it's like, hey, what are we going to work on today? And whatever's bubbling up, mm-hmm. sometimes it's business. It's like, that's the main thing I'm dealing with. And sometimes it's my head, you know, once my brain is. And so, but there's been times when I've had to tell him like, you got to tell me straight up. Like, cause he'll do that. He'll do that positive reinforcement. Like, oh, that's so great. You know? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dude, I need you to tell me what to do, and I need you to tell me what I'm doing wrong.
Right.
Because I need the real, right?
Yeah, so first of all about the like quality of being honest and like open, you know, with in the parameters of like the recovery scene, it's very liberating and like freeing. You know what I mean? Like it almost unshackles you from that, like, feeling that you have to be something or someone else.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I can only speak to my own experience, but at first, in the real world, before I ever was exposed to recovery, that was what my entire life was about. And it might be 10 different people at 10 different times of the day.
Right.
You know what I mean? But when I... You know, they talk about basically honesty being the principle behind the first step. And that was like my experience is you come in the room, like Ryan's talking about, you go to a therapist or a psychiatrist, that person may have altruistic motives and it's just the way that it works. They, you know, you pay them for their time, you know, they're a right. professional, et cetera. And that may not enter into their advice for you or their counsel for you or whatever, but it's in your mind. right? So right. it's so you can't experience that same freedom and liberation through that experience that you can in a room with a bunch of people that don't want anything from you except for your experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. Hey, well said.
I mean, just,
yeah, because I've been in those counseling sessions in those counseling rooms, and I've kind of in my head gone, no, I'm not going to share that.
Right. Why would this person ever tell me that I'm fixed? Because that's the end of their paycheck from me.
Right.
You know, like,
right. Right.
And like I said, that may not necessarily exist, but that's in my head. And you know, as well as I do, whatever's up here is like the reality that I'm living in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, as far as you talking about, you need your therapist to say, do this clear cut directions. Like, you know, I currently have a sponsor who is very big on not giving me direction.
Uh-huh. I can't tell you what to do, but I can give you the suggestion.
Bro, I need you to tell me what to do.
Right. Please.
Hey, you better, because I'm about to screw something up any second.
Yeah.
You know, that's been like...
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've had both kinds of sponsors. I've had one that point his finger, you do this, and you do this, and you do this, and I thrive in that.
Yeah.
You know, but at some point, man, the man-child's got to grow up.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like.
Yeah. Yeah, so, we have to start at some point making those decisions internally.
Yeah, maybe unbridling me one strap at a time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, we wrote out some topics for stuff to cover. They were all just joyful things. Things like fear and character defects and asking for help, following suggestions, which we're kind of covering right now. And so I think there's a little connection here between these two things, and I would say, and I'd like to hear what your guys' experience is on these things, but what I've noticed is there are times when I will use my fellowship and my network almost as a crutch. So I'll experience discomfort, and rather than learning to sit in the discomfort, accept it, and kind of move forward, I can become too dependent on picking up that phone, getting out of my head, getting out of my... And sometimes I think, like... And this is just me, right? I'm not... As I've continued to grow through this whole process, I just feel like, for me, there's been times when it's like, okay, you know what? I need to face this, right? Like, I'll circle back with somebody on this, but in this moment, I need to feel this discomfort. I need to feel this, you know... It's like Ram Dass said that sometimes the pain, avoiding the pain, is more painful than the pain itself, right? So, I mean, does that make any sense to you guys, or have you experienced that at all? Or
not so much the dependence part of it, but knowing to go towards the pain. I've figured that out at some point, but. Yeah. Just because of my circumstances, I kind of found myself isolated. That's where I was at my bottoms. Nobody knew, you know, and I kind of slowly let myself accept that and start seeking some, you know, some meetings and a therapist. But I didn't have a network, not until kind of recently. And I still have to remind myself to do that.
To use it.
So I've had a little bit more of like, I need to make myself step out of myself.
Right.
But I have found that I've gone through some pretty intense experiences lately. I lost my father recently, moved across country to an area that I didn't expect to be in or necessarily want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to figure it out. But I was alone kind of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Though being honest and open about my addiction was freeing. But I did experience pain, and I had to go through it. And I've... You know, I realized that fear and anger, that's the problem. That's where I need to go. And as soon as I shed light on it, it just dissipates. You know, it's something that I've found through that sitting with the pain, that if I just go towards it, it's a lot less scary than if I let it sit there unattended and let it manifest.
Right.
That's where I'm more likely to let that voice in my head that is not constructive have its way.
Yeah. And yeah. So you're saying for you to go towards the pain, it means picking up that phone and calling. Where I'm saying for me to go towards the pain at this stage, it means sitting with it a little bit.
Well,
right?
Well, what I'm saying is I've been by myself and dealt with it. And so yeah. I have had that, and I come away realizing that I have more strength than I thought I had.
Right.
And that I can come through it and be on the other side where if I were using, bottom would have dropped out. It would have been
right. It
would have been a way lower low. But I find now that if I could talk to somebody about it and get it out of my head,
mm-hmm.
then it's something that I can work with.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I have to use other people more often
yeah.
than I've allowed myself.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about recovery is that the way you got sober isn't necessarily the way I have to get sober. And we have to adhere to like certain principles and guidelines and
right.
general ideas and stuff. But the specifics are kind of tailored to our personality. I had to be told to shut up a lot. Ryan's kind of, you know, he's a little more subdued. I don't feel like telling him to shut up is going to help him a whole lot.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he's talking about like his experience dealing with that pain. See, my experience has kind of been what you're talking about is like, dude, my crutch is my like network,
mm-hmm.
you know, and when I have pain, I immediately go to them. It used to be at first when I first got sober, it was like, I'm having this problem. Help me feel better. You know what I mean? Fix this for me.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and now it's more, hey, man, I'm having this problem. I'm aware of some of my like deficiencies in character and how they manifest themselves in my behavior. And that place in the sequence down the road of, addiction or mm-hmm. using, right? And I need you to watch me and hold me accountable. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Because at first that takes very clear-cut direction from
yeah.
someone else for me to open
yeah.
up to people and develop that network and all that stuff. But after a while of doing that, you know, I read somewhere that, you know, what used to be a hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind.
Right.
And so that's like where I revert to now when I'm in pain
yeah.
is I'm like, hey, I'm not doing what I should be doing, or I'm not doing, even if the idea of I'm not doing as well as I should be is bullshit. But even if that is what I'm thinking about,
yeah,
I revert to my network, you
yeah.
know, my guys that I trust that have been sober for a while, that have my best interests at heart and have proven that through their own actions. And that's where I fall into.
Yeah.
I mean, it's worked for me over and over again. It's the only reason. I mean, you're talking to an absolute junkie.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to have been sober for, you know, 2 years the other day is a miracle.
Right.
It's a miracle. And people that know me still are like, man, surely he's had a beer. You know, like,
right. Yeah. So. Well, and when we were talking before we cracked the mics open, and you were saying that there's a period of time in recovery where it's just about don't use. Don't drink, don't use. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing you got to do.
Get some time, yeah.
Get some time. I told somebody that last night. Your main responsibility these next 2 days is don't drink, right? That's it. And then as you kind of move kind of past that, and that obsession leaves, it's like, oh, here's this. It's like, you know, it's like going in Alice's Wonderland. Now all of a sudden, like, look at all this insanity now I have to deal with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we're the issue.
Yeah, that
right
self.
Yeah,
right.
On both sides. We were talking about this on the way down here too. So we'll use drugs and alcohol as the scenario, or mm-hmm. the using of drugs and alcohol. Before, it's, you know, I want to get high, I need to get high, I'm going to get high. And then after I get high, it's I'm a piece of shit, I feel so bad because I got high. But you'll notice that the thing that's consistent through this is I.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so no matter what side of the regrettable action that you take or took or whatever, it's still about I.
Yeah.
On both sides of it. And it says very plainly, you know, in my literature, selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of our trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I read that stuff in the book and it's like, okay, I know this in my brain. I know this theoretically, but it's only through my own mistakes that it moves from my brain to my heart.
Yeah. Living it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Is it the same for you?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I totally relate to that. I had a singularity of purpose when I was using it was, how do I find it? How do I get high? Right. And then afterwards it's, why am I like this? Why am I such an awful piece of shit? And as I got sober, that acceptance becomes a huge thing. I can accept that things around me, it's not their fault, you know, and I don't need to get mad or upset about everything. And then you slowly realize that my problems are right back here.
Yeah.
It's that voice in me. And it's that uneasiness that you get, that just like uncomfortableness. And it's, I almost become obsessed with trying to find out where I am all the time, you know, in my sobriety. And I have to get out and do something like this or get out and help somebody in order to get out of my own head and get out of my own way.
Right.
And, you know, we were talking about prayer and meditation.
Yeah.
And those are the things that also I can start to understand, or at least distract that voice in my head long enough to not be thinking about myself all the time or telling myself that I'm not worthy all the time.
Yeah.
That's
that inner judge, that inner critic that's always in there.
That's the problem. It's not anything else. It's that. That's my biggest problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm reading this book. I was telling Ryan about this a little while ago. I'm reading this book called Radical Acceptance. I'm sure it's well known, but it basically ties those two things together. Like, it calls it the trance of unworthiness. Hmm. You know, in the wake of said behavior, something is wrong with me. You know, I think it's probably inherent to human beings to have this idea that something is wrong.
Yeah.
But the ego turns it into something's wrong with me. I'm deficient. I'm not good enough.
Right.
You know, again.
Right. Ay-yi-yi-yi-yi.
Which is like actually very appropriate. Ay-yi-yi-yi.
Ay-yi-yi.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. That's been kind of a... we were talking about counselors and stuff, and that's one of the... My counselor gave me this thing called positive intelligence test. And I can't remember the guy's name. If you Google positive intelligence, his website comes up. You can take a free assessment. And what this guy's concept is, he surveyed like hundreds of corporate execs, like, to find out what was the main reason why some of these execs weren't experiencing success. Like, what were their issues? And so he came out with this theory where basically your brain is trying to do one of two things. It's either putting you in a position of thriving or it's trying to sabotage you. And so he developed these several different, what he called saboteurs. And so the saboteurs, like for me, when I did the test, my saboteurs are hyperachiever, right? I got to rent a studio and put mics in it and lights and do a podcast, and I got to do all this because I can't just... Right? I'm not saying this all comes out of hyperachieving, but it's kind of like, and then restless, right? The next thing will be better, you know, if I just do this, if I do that. But everybody has, in his theory, everybody has the judge. That judge is saying, this is wrong, this is right. And that comes from our kind of fight or flight kind of, you know, survival mechanism, right?
Right.
Like, I had a counselor tell me to do yoga because she's like, you got to tell your body that the tiger is not chasing you, you know? And when you get in some of them yoga positions, there's no way you're in that position if a tiger's chasing you, you know? Right. And it's interesting, that whole kind of framework, when I was exposed to it, I thought, man, that makes so much sense, because that's where a lot of my ongoing issues come from. This hyperachiever that's saying, you got to do better. Right, you got to do more. What you're doing is not enough. And then imagine that judge in there who's going, yeah, what he said, because look at what you did yesterday. And it's so apparent, like in my own life, I can have a great day, busy day, you know, get up, kick butt all day. I can go to bed going, man, what? Just did I miss the mark? Something was off. What happened? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's that disease in my brain, you know, the disease of I is trying to, you know, it's so harmful to a lot of us, you know, and I think that's why I'm grateful for recovery, because recovery forces me to look inward. If I wasn't an addict, I'm not doing any of this work. I'm not doing none of it.
No. Mm-hmm.
But I know that if I don't do the work, then a lot of people are going to get hurt, me included.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The hyperachieving or underachieving, like, you know, either I'm not good enough or I'm better than everybody else, it, like, has its parallels with somewhere that I find myself in recovery is living in the past or living in the future. You know what I mean? It's
right.
It's not good enough. It's I'm better than everybody else. It's, you know, regretting what I did in the past, worried about what I'll do in the future. And all of those things seem to, like, suggest that I do not naturally gravitate towards, like, living in the present and just being in the middle of the pack.
Right.
You know what I mean? I got to be dead last or dead first. You know?
Right. Right.
And it's like,
we were talking about something similar on the way down here, tendency to want to compare yourself to others. You know, it's just always going to lead you down a road of self-doubt and eventually shame. And that's where that attitude of being grateful, it's the only thing you can really do to ever stop that. Because No matter what you achieve, you want the next thing. And then will you enjoy that for 30, 45 minutes, and then you want the next thing. You
right.
know, I mean, when you ever really feel grateful or happy or fulfilled, mm-hmm. you actually have to make yourself do that, and you have to practice it.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think a lot of the Buddhist philosophy and teaching is so helpful, at least for me, because it does teach a lot of that kind of that disattachment, or, like, you know, you watch your thoughts floating down a river like you watch leaves floating down a river, mm-hmm. that you're not your thoughts, you're, you know, you're you, and to create that separation, you know, the ability to pause when agitated, right?
Yeah.
That's a you know, Buddhist philosophy too, is like to create space between your actions and your thoughts, you know, and understanding that you're the one, you know.
Yeah, the idea of responding rather than reacting.
Yeah.
Which is just, I mean, absolute, like, base weakness of mine. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I heard it described as basically what you're talking about is mindfulness.
Right.
Right. And so I heard it the other day described as like sitting behind a waterfall. You know what I mean? Whereas, like, for a while, you're in the waterfall because you're, you know.
Right.
And then eventually, as you become more mindful, you, like, shift behind the waterfall. So now you're watching all your thoughts and emotions go by without necessarily having to, like, participate in them.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That'll preach right there. So you celebrated 2 years, which kind of was the motivating thing that got us here.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, hey, now's time. Let's get it out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me, I would love for you to tell me, like, 2 years and kind of look, take that back to one, and then take it back to that first 60 days. Tell me the change, Dan's change. What's different about Dan in those three phases?
You want me to go from 2 to 1 to ground zero?
Yeah.
The atom bomb explosion that brought me in the door.
Yeah.
It may not, like, necessarily seem like a logical progression, because in my mind, when I thought about how I would recover, it would be ground zero, a pile of shit, right? And then year one, getting better. Year two, getting better than that. Year three, and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah.
I'm consistently on this linear path of getting better. I think that may be true as far as whether or not I'm getting better. But that is not true for whether or not I feel better.
The experience.
And those are two very different things.
Yeah.
Getting better and feeling better have been very, very different things. Right. I'll even go so far as to say that rarely has getting better felt better. An example for me is, bro, I can go get me a fat shot right now and feel much better and get much worse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I'm the time, it's been told to me for years at this point that when I'm in pain, those are opportunities to grow, or when I'm in pain that I am growing and that kind of thing. But when you're growing, you're in pain, and thus it does not feel good. So you're asking me about my path of recovery over the past 2 years. Today, I am, first and foremost, like, just, I don't even know. I worry about how much, like, awe I'm in of being sober sometimes. Almost like, I don't think it's that I don't believe in myself, but it's been very, very hard for me to get sober. I've been going to meetings for over 10 years. You know, I won't say that I ever made a valiant effort at getting sober until really 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. And today, I'm very grateful for that. I realize in my heart, not just my head, that my sobriety is the only thing that has made anything else possible for me. Having a healthy relationship with a girl, succeeding at a job, being dependable, being there for other people. So thus, like, increasing my usefulness and like my positive ripple effect in my little minute corner of the world. Yeah. You know, all these things were launched from sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
But today I've also scraped that 1 year layer off the onion, you know. Uh-huh. And I realize how deep some of this stuff goes.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
More to be revealed.
So I think at 1 year, if I'd have realized all this, I would have freaked out and it may have, like, jeopardized my sobriety. I think at 2 years, the difference is that I realized, man, okay, you ain't fixed, you ain't cured, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? 'Cause that wasn't okay at one point.
Right.
You know, that was a perplexing and depressing, like, thing to realize. And now it's like, okay.
Yeah, you're accepting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1 year, like, 9 month pink cloud.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, I had the, like, biggest pink cloud. I was, like, crying tears of gratitude and, you know, seeing rainbow. I really was. Like, I had a very long pink cloud period, and it was a very steep drop off after that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And I got squirrely from, like, 9 to 14 months.
Well, what kept you sober there during that time, 9 to 14?
Accountability, first and foremost. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and act like I stayed sober because I had built this life for which I wanted to stay sober and all this other bullshit. Like, it was that I was in an environment of accountability, and I had people that I had ingrained myself with that were watching me.
Yeah.
And that helped me.
Yeah.
And I had become trained. One of the only things I had become trained at was vocalizing when I was going through pain, like we were talking about. I had just begun to make leaning into my network of guys a habit.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably what kept me sober.
Yeah.
That and the fact that I never stopped getting on my knees to pray in the morning and at night.
Really?
Yep. And every time
I always hear that, it's always just so anecdotal, you know?
It's because it's true.
Yeah.
Every time I'd ever relapse, what immediately preceded that was me not praying anymore. And I thought to myself, this is bullshit, man. These people, you know, you can chalk it up to prayer if you want to, but until it happened to me,
yeah,
I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And then it happened to me, and I was like, you know what, I've been through a lot of tough shit in the past couple of years, and I've stayed sober, and I've never got off my knees in the morning and at night.
It's the simplicity of it.
Wow. Yeah, it's convicting, too, a little bit.
I mean, dude, you can deny it all you want to, but it's factual.
Right, and you're saying you're physically the act of getting on your knees and praying.
Oh, yeah. See, that was the difference.
It's one thing to lay in bed all comfortable and cozy. Right. Oh, Lord, just bless this day before me.
Yep.
As it is in the physical act.
And, dude, try doing it in a room with another grown man with two twin beds. You feel weird. But when you get desperate enough, I don't give a shit what Joe thinks. I have to do this.
Yeah.
And, like, the other thing is I used to get in bed, pull the covers up, be like, oh, shit, I didn't pray. And then I'd be like, I'd be all right. Now I'm, like, levitating out of bed to, like, make sure I do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
The physical, connecting the physical to the spiritual.
I think it probably expresses some form of, like, humility or... like, maybe shapes your, like, belief in that you're, like, you know, serving something else or have something else to live for, taking direction from, like, you know. But also, man, one of my friends said it, like, best. It's like, if you're laying in bed on your back and that's the amount of effort you're putting into your, you know, asking God to get sober, how much effort do you think he's going to put in?
Boy, convicting the shit out of me right now, dog. For real.
Yeah. I mean, dude, how much do you really expect to get out of that? You get what you put, you get out what you put in.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Well, in last year, I'm in a seminary program, an interfaith seminary program. And so we have to learn and study other faiths and take on some of their practices. And so last year we did Islam, and one of the prayers was a Sufi prayer, body prayer. And so you've probably seen, it's a version of what you've probably seen if you've ever seen, we don't see it too much out here in Georgia, but you know, if you're in New York or the LA area, you might see like a Muslim at that certain time of day, they'll lay their carpet down facing the east.
Right.
Then they do this prayer where they stand up, they get down, they get on their knees, they go down on the ground, and they come back up. And there's certain words you say as you do each one. So that was the practice I adopted during that month. And the first time I did it, I was like, whoa.
That's cool.
This is like putting the word and the physical, the spiritual and the physical together, right? That practice was powerful. And so right now, as you're saying it, you know what I mean? Like I'm having a little therapy right now because I'm going, you know what, dude? I got to do it. It's that physical discipline and the practice of connecting whatever God is to whatever reality is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. I've actually had the thought when I'm doing this, like, should I be facing east? I mean, like, randomly.
Try it.
I have no background in Islam or anything like that, and it's, like, occurred to me out of nowhere. Like,
try it. Dude. It'd be interesting to know, and you got to kind of know where east is.
I do.
Yeah.
In my room.
You do face east.
And I know where it is.
Okay.
I typically face north.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is relevant at all, but...
Well, no. So being in this seminary, I've been exposed to a lot of different... you know, philosophies and thoughts about this stuff. And so there are a lot of indigenous ways of spirituality where they're really connecting with the north and the south and the east and the west. And each, there's a reason why in Islam they pray to the east, right? The sun rises in the east. And there's some, again, connecting physical to the spiritual. You know, when you're looking to the north, there's some certain properties that you look for in the north because nature kind of reveals itself in this. I don't know if I'm digressing too far going somewhere, but it's cool. Like, you know, and sometimes we'll do these prayers in this big room and everyone will go like, to the east, we pray to the wind of the northern parts. Yeah. And I'm like,
what is it?
But when it's done and I'm done judging the whole thing, my cynical brain.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, that's kind of cool.
Well, the thing about it is that it plays into this, like, God of your own understanding.
Right.
But one of the things that I think I messed this up for years was a God of your own understanding is not synonymous with a God of your convenience.
Dang.
You know what I mean? So I say, oh, well, God don't give a damn if I lay on my back and say this prayer. So that I don't have to get out of bed. Oh, God loves me even though I'm nodding off flipping cars across I-26 in South Carolina. That's because I don't want to quit doing it. You know, so it's like You tell a drug addict or an alcoholic, hey, develop a God of your own understanding. It's like, oh, well, you know, and so then I'm not working on anything.
Right.
Because God loves me and all my imperfections, and it's all good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great. There's a difference between a God of your own understanding and a God of your own convenience.
Yep.
Yeah, I like that.
So we're I think at time here. So, but I want to give you a chance to just kind of close us out. Like, tell, you got people listening, hopefully, mm-hmm. to this point, right? And wherever stage they're at, what hope and strength can you give to that person who's still suffering?
What hope and strength can I give?
Yeah.
Well, I've been focusing on this idea of strength. I think that there's a lot of humility that goes into the beginning of getting sober. But I'm at a year and a half now, and I'm starting to realize that I'm growing, and that I've found some strength within this program, this 12-step program, to where when terrible things do happen, when you lose somebody close to you, or you go through something devastating, that fall isn't as far. You have tools that you can use, and you have mental and emotional strength that you didn't have before. Now, there's still pain and there's still hurt, but it doesn't have to be as bad as it was.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly how I got there. You know, there's a certain amount of work involved. Anytime there's pain, there's reinforcement afterwards. You know, there's the things you learn. There's the growth that, you know, having a spiritual life is something that has definitely helped me with that. That's something that I avoided for a long time, and, you know, finally get to a depth of despair where you got to have something, you know, and that's just an area of your life that if it's not reinforced as well, I mean, it's going to be weak, you know, and that gives me something to lean on other than myself, because I wasn't able to do it myself for so long. I mean, I was at a point of just wanting to kill myself, you know,
right.
when I got to the low point before I came into these rooms. And I don't feel like I'll be anywhere close to that anytime soon. It would take using again to mm-hmm. get back there.
Yeah.
So that's where, you know, at a year and a half, that's where I find myself, is that I have a strength that I didn't realize I had.
Yeah.
And when I'm having low points, it's because I'm forgetting that, you know.
Right.
And so...
Yeah. Dan, you have your thought face is a confused face.
Everybody tells me this in meetings.
Yeah, I see.
They're like, dude, you should see your face when people are talking. I'm
you're
going
to get to see it now. That's awesome. That was great. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
All right.